Thank you, Chris. Sasha has nicely stirred things up with a most intriguing talk. I want to come to a different aspect of helioseismology, which is what we've learnt from global mode helioseismology, and then in rather smaller letters that may be relevant to the solar dynamo. And there are a couple of things that that I will touch on here that I think are also very intriguing, and I'm not sure have as yet been explained. So global mode helioseismology, we use the resonant global modes, measuring in particular their frequencies. The frequencies in a spherically symmetric body would be independent of the azimuthal order M, but that degeneracy is lifted by things that break the spherical symmetry, so in particular by rotation and by structural asphericities and magnetic fields, and that's how we've been able to make deductions about in particular, the rotation. I should say that apart from very near the surface, from local techniques, we have no direct, unambiguous detections of magnetic fields in the deeper interior. In particular, we only have upper bounds, basically a null result from the Tucker-Klein. So we get maps of the rotation, the sound speed, and so on. I just want to point out that the global modes, because of their symmetry, are only sensitive to a north-south symmetric component of the structure or the rotation. If you made a dent in one hemisphere or a dent in the other hemisphere, they would have an identical effect on the global mode frequencies. So from the frequencies alone, we can't say anything about north-south asymmetries. And typically, we use about 2 months of data, so these are two-month averages. So most of the work has been done from networks or from space. So in particular, MDI Golf and Virgo on SOHO. And as Sasha mentioned, we look forward in the next few months to the launch of Solar Dynamics Observatory. And then from the ground, the two most successful networks, Bison and Gong, which are both under threat at the moment. Just schematically, this shows that we've really been doing helioseismology now over the last three activity cycles. So what's shown here for different major instruments or networks indicates when, against time, they were making observations, and the fill of their bar indicates the duty cycle. So in particular, you'll see that since over the most recent cycle, we've had Gong and SOHO looking with essentially 100% duty cycle at the sun. So we've got very good observations over the last solar cycle. We had the ITP. Some of us were lucky enough to spend 6 months until we had another fire around there. Yeah. So that was very much looking forward to the coming online of Gong and SOHO. Well, just to summarise some of the results, as far as rotation is concerned, so now we've been able to observe the rotation over an 11-year cycle, revealing the deep structure of the migrating zonal patterns known as torsional oscillations. I'll show those results, giving hints of other periodicities. I will review that as well, and then we've looked also for temporal changes in the structure of the solar interior, but those are more challenging to measure because the dominant effect comes from near-surface magnetic fields, and I'll show that as well. So this is very familiar to everyone, I think, that using these techniques we've revealed the existence of the Tucker-Klein. The contours of constant rotation, isorotation, at mid-latitudes are roughly radial. They seem, in fact, to have a tilt angle of about 25 degrees to the rotation axis. And there is also this surface shear layer, which, as Axel has pointed out, may have may in fact be where dynamo action is occurring, but most people think it's happening, as you know, down in the tachocline. Let me just say that the tachocline, the position of the tachocline is, and the thickness of it is very hard to judge actually from figures like this one on the right-hand side, and that's because of the finite resolution of our inversion techniques, which are ultimately limited by the wavelength of the waves that we're using, but also by the noise properties, and we're trying to make a trade-off between the error bars that we produce on our inversions and the spatial resolution. And in fact, the tachocline width is about 3% of the solar radius in the equatorial low latitude regions, and it seems to be about twice that width, so about 7% when you get up to about 60 degrees. The tachocline also appears to be prolate, so that it's the centre of the tachocline is at about 0.69 solar radii at low latitudes, and about 0.71 solar radii at about 60 degrees. And just for completion, here is what the rotation looks like if you go deeper down. So now the upper parts of the convection zone have been cut off. So this is only going from 0.8 solar radii and then down to the centre with different data. And you'll see in particular the effect here of bringing in the data from the Bison network, the low degree network. There is a hint that the rotation rate actually gets slower as you get down into the energy generating core, but the error bars, which are only one sigma here, are very large, so it's entirely consistent with body rotation. So that was the rotation. I'll come back to temporal variation of the rotation, but here is a picture of the sound speed in the sun as a function of radius from the center to the surface. And although this is from a model, you'll see that the deviations from the model are extremely small when I show those in a second. But of course, the kind of things that we can measure from the sound speed are the depth of the convection zone, where we have a noticeable change in the gradient of the sound speed. We can also see the effects of the buildup of helium in the core. Out here, we can measure the helium abundance of the convective envelope by looking at the effect on the sound speed. And beneath the base of the convection zone, we see the effects of the opacity to radiation, but also modified by gravitational settling of elements out of the heavier elements out of the convection zone. So indeed, this is the relative difference between the sound speed, the squared sound speed actually in the sun, minus that in a current model. And we see that the differences are extremely small, a fraction of 1%. But they also seem to be quite significant. The one sigma error bars shown here are many times smaller than these deviations. So beneath the base of the convection zone, there is a significant deviation in the sound speed, and it probably indicates that there is some extra mixing going on in the sun, which is not included in the model. And this deviation in the outer part of the core is also a persistent feature of our inversions. So there's been a lot of talk in the last few years about the solar abundances. Martin Asplund and colleagues revised the solar surface abundances, reducing the oxygen to hydrogen ratio by almost a factor of 2, which together with some other elements basically reduced very significantly the metallicity of the sun, if one assumes that their measurements are characteristic of the whole of the solar interior. And this work came from improvements in various aspects of the analysis. So this has a major effect on our agreement between the helioseismic measurements of the sun and our models. So here was the discrepancy between the sun and our models with the old abundances. This is the discrepancy between the sun and our models if the models introduce a lower metallicity. And there's been a lot of work done to try and resolve that discrepancy. And nothing has really managed to bring the helioseismology completely back in line to the extent that it was with the old abundances. Well, I was very interested that to hear about a very recent paper. I think it's still a preprint, but it should appear in Astronomy and Astrophysics by Caffo et al. And they've actually looked again at the determination made by Asplund and colleagues. And they've come up with a couple of reasons why they believe that Asplund is actually underestimating the oxygen abundances to do with the details of the analysis, the equivalent widths that they use in their analysis of the observations, and also apparently a neglect of collisions between hydrogen atoms with the oxygen, I think, in the statistical equilibrium calculations. And so what these guys are now saying is that they think that the oxygen abundance is up again, not quite as high as we had previously, but getting consistent now. What we can accommodate with the helioseismology. Well, one of the variations in the rotation rate are these torsion oscillations, which are known for 25 years now from surface measurements. These are these bands of persistent flow that go towards the equator following the magnetic active latitudes. We've seen from helioseismology that those bands of faster flow, shown here in red, actually are not just at the surface but penetrate down, well, we reckon at least in this work from 2000, at least down a third of the way into the convection zone, and then they seem to break up. Some more recent analysis by Sergei Vorontsov and colleagues, again showing these bands of faster flow moving towards the equator at low latitudes, and also revealing a strong an increase in flow at flow speeds at high latitudes over the solar cycle. So this goes from minimum to 2002, showing that these flows, these zonal flows, seem to extend down quite a way into the convection zone. This is another cut. So this basically shows the rotation rate so this would be 1 year after solar minimum minus the rotation rate at solar minimum. And so this is the band going down in successive years towards the equator. Here are some slower bands, and then this is the speed up near the pole, or high latitudes anyway. I should point out these are very weak flows compared with the overall rotation rate. We're talking about flows of a few meters a second, so 1 nanohertz in terms of a rotation rate compared with an overall rotation rate of 400-odd nanohertz. Okay, well, this just shows how the torsion oscillation is varying with time. Again, so this is a latitude against time plot. This is the actual data, and then this is an extension by assuming a sinusoidal temporal extension with an 11-year period. But this is the equatorward branch. This is apparently a poleward branch. And if we look again at those data, but instead of looking with latitude and time, if we look at depth and time at different latitudes, we see, again, the red is faster rotation. So this blob here is the equatorward branch. So at this early time, it's at 30 degrees. A bit later, it's at 15 degrees. A bit later, it's at the equator. But what happens with depth is that at low and mid latitudes, we seem to get an evolution, a phase evolution up from depths towards the surface rather than the other way around. And then at mid latitudes and higher, things seem to all happen at about the same time. At all depths. Well, in addition to those migrations, we have seen hints of variations in the tachocline as far as the rotation rate is concerned, even though we haven't seen a magnetic field there. We were looking to see whether there was something like an 11-year variation. In fact, found something that looked like a 1.3-year variation. So these are residuals of the rotation around a temporal mean at the equator at 0.72 solar radii at the equator at 30 degrees and at 60 degrees. And we published this not knowing that this periodicity had been reported in other observations. We should have known, but we were later told that it's also been seen in solar wind measurements, in auroral measurements, and indeed in the photospheric mean magnetic field. So this is just a close-up on the variation that we saw at the base of the convection zone. So this is something that we're saying looks like a 1.3-year period that then seems to die out, and then possibly has another go at going in 2002 and then dies out again. We can look at that with different data sets and with different inversion techniques, and it gets a bit messy. But it's kind of there in all of them, in the early period, the rise of the solar cycle, and then gets rather messy afterwards. And indeed, if you add in the later data, so this was after we'd published the result, it certainly gets less significant. So this is the 1.3-year oscillation with a best fit sinusoid, and this is the power at different frequencies at that particular location. And as we add more data, this 1.3-year peak certainly gets less significant, which simply means that the sun, of course, is not maintaining a constant 1.3-year sinusoidal oscillation. But this is just to show you that one sees something similar in the photospheric mean magnetic field measurements. So this is a waveless analysis on the bottom of the mean magnetic field. This is the rotation period, so we're just seeing the same active regions coming around over several rotation periods, and it's first harmonic. But this thing here is corresponding roughly to this 1.3 or 1.4-year oscillation, apparently. I won't say anything about the meridional circulation, which can't be seen directly from the global modes. But I will just finish by saying something about a possible detection of something which could be a magnetic field in the convection zone. And that comes from looking at the even M, so-called even A coefficient. So if we take the frequencies of the global modes at fixed radial order and spherical harmonic degree, then the frequencies depend on the azimuthal order of the mode. And all I've done here is basically just expanded that in terms of some polynomials, the exact definitions of which is not particularly relevant. So these coefficients, these A's, are the coefficients that tell us how the frequencies vary with azimuthal degree M as you go from one mode to another at fixed radial order N and spherical harmonic degree L. So the odd coefficients in that expansion are the ones that we've used to deduce the rotation. So the even M's, the even coefficients are telling us about things which affect eastward and westward propagating waves in the same manner as one another. So that could be thermal asphericities, it could be magnetic fields. So the first thing to note is that these even A coefficients do vary with time. So here are various coefficients in that polynomial expansion. This was my A2, my A4, my A6, and so on up to A12, plotted from 1995 to 2002. So these things definitely do vary with time, which is telling us that the frequencies vary with time in a quite systematic way as we proceed through the solar cycle. However, if instead of plotting those frequencies against time, sorry, those A coefficients against time, we plot them against the surface photospheric magnetic field projected onto Legendre polynomials, we get an extremely tight correlation. So the A2 coefficient, for example, of the frequency is extremely tightly correlated with a projection of the surface magnetic field onto the second Legendre polynomial, and so on, A4 onto the fourth polynomial, and so on. So what this is telling us is either that the change in the frequencies is basically this particular aspect of the frequencies is coming about caused by the surface magnetic field, which is what I would contend or if not, then whatever's changing the frequencies is itself extremely tightly correlated with what the photospheric magnetic field's doing. So this is going from, looks like minus 30 to plus 10. So basically, I would contend that the frequency variations are almost all being caused by something near the surface. But in our inversions, we can take that out, that effect out, and then we can say, well, what's left? So we take out this bit which comes from the surface, and we say, well, there's a bit that comes from the interior. Let's do our inversion on that. So if we do that, and this is the penultimate slide, what we see is the following. So this is these are plots at a radius of this is a plot latitude and radius. These are contours of the relative frequency perturbation that we would infer from these even A coefficients. So what we're looking at is the asphericity in the wave propagation speed. And the significant feature that I want to draw your attention to is this maximum here and again here. So this is two different data sets. This is gong data, this is MDI data, and this is data that's been taken over a number of years. And what we see here apparently is a local maximum, so some positive perturbation to the sound speed at about 60 degrees latitude and at a radius of about 0.9 solar radii. It could be a thermal anomaly. The magnitude of it is about, in fractional terms, is about 10 to the minus 4 of the local sound speed. It could be caused by magnetic fields sitting there, conceivably. And this last plot, which, apologise, it's rather busy, it shows the analysis of two different data sets in three different years. Plotted against latitude and at different radial locations. But the only point I want to make based on this plot is that all these curves are in very good agreement at various locations, but particularly 0.9 and 0.94, in producing a local maximum in the wave speed as a function of latitude. So this feature, whatever it is, if it's not an artifact of our analysis in some way that we haven't yet tracked down, seems to be largely independent of time, and a significant feature of the heliocentric data set. So thank you very much.
Okay. Tammy?
So the early figure you showed that from the Bison network about the rotation in the deep, deep interior, mm-hmm. You said it was consistent with uniform, but it seemed to not be consistent with fast rotation. And I can't remember what the possible detection from gravity waves says, but I thought it said something like fast rotating. And do you have any comments about that or... am I right? I can't remember because they have a prediction about the deep interior rotation rate based on those possible detections as well.
Yeah, well, there was a paper fairly recently by Savita Mathur and collaborators where they were looking at the sensitivity of the gravity modes to rotation, and certainly showing that if we got firm detections of gravity modes, then they could really constrain things much better in this region than we currently are. So just coming back to the earlier part of your question, I'm not sure how visible it is, but that's the top of the 1 sigma error bar. That's the bottom of the 1 sigma error bar. So it's favoring slower rotation rather than faster rotation, these P modes, but I wouldn't say anything is really very strongly ruled out by these. And what Savita Mathur and collaborators were saying was you really could get much tighter constraints if you saw the G modes. Now, they did use as an illustrative example in their paper a possible detection of a G-mode splitting, which I think was something like 700 nanohertz. So, but I think I'm being fair to the group and I don't know whether Sasha will have anything to say perhaps about that, but I don't think they were in any sense pushing that as an actual measurement that we should actually at this stage use seriously.
You showed these cross-sections, meridional cross-sections with the angular velocity at different times in the cycle, where you had this big orange-reddish blob at high latitudes. My suggestion is, and maybe you have this, to show this, to show not just different times.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Not just show you, but you weighted with this rho to the square root of rho, mm-hmm. because that would be the quantity that is most directly related to the magnetic response.
Okay.
Do you have that already? Do you know how that changes with depth?
I don't have it here, but I think probably Rachel Howe and Rudy Kohn may have published that, but we can check. I can't remember, I'm afraid.
Okay, I think we've got just one more question over there.
Do the odd A coefficients show the same correlation with magnetic flux density? And if so, was that removed when the Tagaklein 1.3-year oscillation was detected?
No, they don't show the same. They don't show the same correlation. And no, it was not removed.
Okay. I think we better move on now. Thank you very much, Mike.